Welcome to the Listnik podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Tay.
And I'm your co-host, Nick Bell. And we get down and dirty with the world's leading business minds. And to top it off, nothing is off limits.
And on today's episode, we catch up with former FBI negotiator and author of Never Split the Difference, Chris Voss. So our next guest, I'm so bloody excited for because I actually wanted, probably like you, wanted to be like an FBI, like, you know, work in the FBI when I was growing up.
You know, I wanted to join the feds when I was younger. I actually applied, but I was rejected.
Oh, no.
It breaks my heart even talking about it.
So sad. Well, our next guest actually spent 24 years working in the FBI Crisis Negotiation Unit and was the FBI's chief international hostage and kidnap negotiator from 2003 to 2007, which is, like, I am so excited to hear all about that. And after he retired from the FBI, he actually founded the Black Swan Group. So it teaches businesses and individuals on how to negotiate. And if that wasn't enough, he also co-authored the book Never Split the Difference. And I personally actually love this book because I work in sales. So I love the art of negotiation and learn a lot from this book. So I'm excited to learn a little bit more and share that, some top tips with our audience. So welcome to the show, Chris Voss.
Thank you very much.
Welcome, Chris. Welcome. Mate, I'm going to get straight into the meat and potatoes. We could talk about your past, and that's fantastic, but what I really want to know is, what was the craziest negotiation you were involved in whilst you're at the FBI? Crazy, off the record crazy.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, the Chase Manhattan bank robbery hostage taking, which is fairly early in my hostage negotiation career, you know, despite what there is on the movies where bank robberies with hostages happen in every movie that has hostages, right? That where you negotiate in a bank for hostages is actually a really rare event. Like it won't happen in the United States one time this year. Mm. And when it went down in New York, it had been 20 years since there'd been a bank robbery with hostages that had occurred. So it was really cool that I got to be part of, you know, almost a historical event.
It's actually crazy because I feel like hostage negotiation seems like the movies. So is it really glamorized, or is it sort of what you expected when you walked into the FBI on day one and you sort of got involved in negotiations, or is it quite different to what we see in the movies?
Yeah, well, you know, it's really crisis intervention most of the time. Even a Chase Bank with the bad guys inside the bank robbers. I mean, the guy that surrendered to me, he actually, when he went there that day, he didn't know they were going to rob the bank. He thought they were going to burglarize the cash machine. You know, the guy that manipulated it, which taught me a lot about great business negotiators because he was a very control-oriented guy. Part of his manipulation was he didn't tell the other guys they were actually going to take hostages going to vault. The plan he outlined to them was that they were going to slip in, they were going to burglarize the cash machine, they were going to get out. So the guys that didn't know that they were going to get caught inside, suddenly they're surrounded by what's been referred to as the seventh largest standing army in the world, the NYPD. And he's genuinely worried about, you know, the sniper putting a red dot on his forehead. So the guy's in crisis. He doesn't want to die. And it's really crisis intervention a lot more than the silly bargaining that takes place in most movies.
So what was the outcome of that? Did you end up negotiating with the bank robber and he surrendered, or what was the outcome?
Yeah, well, everybody surrendered. Everybody came out. There were three hostages inside. The lead bank robber, this guy, his name also happened to be Chris.
There we go. That's perfect for you.
You know, it's a sign of a negotiator, right? It's a sign of somebody to watch out for. He just wouldn't do what we wanted him to do. And he tried to, for example, when I got the second bank robber to surrender to me. He met me personally outside. So then we're trying to get him to surrender. Well, he's got three hostages on the inside. He's a smart dude. He knows that if he lets a hostage go, it decreases the likelihood that we're going to come in the door. You know, it buys him time. So out of the blue, he decides to let a hostage go, which catches us off guard. and we get another hostage out of them. So now, you know, we got a succession of hostages going. This thing's going on about 10 hours. Interestingly enough, these types of situations with this specific profile will often last about 12 hours.
Wow.
And so then, you know, we're working on him to let the last hostage go. And the only way he can stay in control is he volunteers to come out. He says, well, I'll come out, because he doesn't want to agree to anything we want. So, you know, we got everybody out alive. It was interesting when he came out. He, you know, he had his hands up and he's looking around. You could tell he's looking for any opportunity to run. So right up to the moment that he was handcuffed, he was still working on getting away.
Yeah, that's actually crazy. I remember listening to your audiobook, and it was just interesting when you were talking about how when you're in negotiations with people, you have up to six people listening to what they're saying, which I thought was actually quite interesting, because you talk a lot about how active listening is so important when it comes to negotiation. And I was talking to someone about this yesterday, because in society today, I think we're so focus on ourselves and the million and one things that we have to do. So you're talking to people and you're sort of thinking about how, when they're talking to you, you're thinking about how to respond as opposed to actually listening. And we all have these, you know, inherent biases when we're listening and talking to people. And you were saying that you need at least like six people so you can make sure that you're really actually hearing what's being said. So can you talk about the importance of active listening when it comes to negotiation?
Yeah, you know, active, and also I'd say if you're learning a Black Swan method, you know, if we're teaching you, how to be proactive. It's one of the reasons why, you know, we use the term tactical empathy versus just empathy. Because we've taken hostage negotiation and we've added neuroscience and a bunch of other stuff. So what am I talking about? Well, first of all, going in, people are wired to be negative. Your survival mode. Everybody's got an amygdala. You know, it's most people have heard of something called an amygdala in our brain, and people have heard the amygdala hijacked as if it's something that takes over when you're angry. Well, the amygdala is operating all the time, and it's 75% negative. That's survival mode. You know, it's how we're wired to survive. We've inherited from the cavemen. The pessimistic cavemen survived. The optimistic ones got eaten. So if I know that proactively going in, I know as a Black Swan, your decision-making process is going to be negative. I'm going to clear those negatives out to start off with. Like, I'm going to say, you know, if we sit down for a meeting, you're already going to be wondering if you're wasting your time. So I'm going to start out by saying, like, look, I know you're probably already thinking this is going to be a waste of your time. That's actually deactivated a negative. Or the other cool thing about that approach is it inoculates from negatives. I mean, I can actually control how you're going to react over the next few moments by inoculating you from negatives. If I'm getting ready to ask you for money, you're inherently going to think I'm greedy. That's a human nature reaction. So before I get ready to ask for money, I'm probably going to say something like, look, this is probably going to seem greedy. Versus most people are going to want to say, look, I don't want to seem greedy. That's the denial. The 2 millimeter shift, you know, from this style of negotiating is, instead of denying it, deactivating it by calling it out. And almost nobody knows to do that.
Yeah.
So could you use this in a negotiation, even a straight, for example, cold call? So I'm reaching out to a business. They have no idea who I am. I'm trying to attract them as a customer. Can I use that tactic to potentially lure them in?
Yeah. Well, yeah, lure. That, you know, lure.
Lure sounds so lewd, doesn't it?
What kind of business are you running?
We want to invite them in, you know, invite them in. Now, yeah, you know, we teach, you know, some of what we teach is cold calling. I mean, what's a predictable thought pattern in a cold call? What's a predictable bad behavior? First of all, somebody cold calls you, you know it's a cold call before somebody cold calls me. They're going to say, could I speak to Chris Voss, please? Right? Meant to be respectful. None of my friends say, could I speak to Chris Voss, please? You've already told me you're a salesperson and you're selling me something.
Yeah.
So now my guard is immediately up.
Yeah.
Next thing you're going to do is you're probably going to say, can I have a few moments of your time?
I feel like this is your script.
This is the old me.
Again, meant to be very respectful. The problem is it's a yes-oriented question. The last person that hustled me started out with a yes-oriented question of some sort. You know, the yes momentum selling is taught badly everywhere. Get them to say yes three times. Those are called micro agreements, also known as tie downs. And then they have to say yes to the last thing you got them. Now that sounds really appealing and safe to a salesperson in training that doesn't know any better. And it's how most cold calls are scripted. Get three yeses, then ask for the meeting or ask for whatever your ask is. The problem is the guy that conned me and cheated me used that same approach. So I've already been burned. And I'm not going to know that you're a good guy, that you got a good product that I could use. I know that you're engaging in the same behavior that the person that cheated me is. So I'm automatically going to start to push back. If you're being trained as a black swan, if you come to our company and we teach you, I'll give you, and we give a lot of stuff away for free, which is another reason to check us out, because we want you to be fairly good before we get you into the complicated stuff. Cold call should go like this. Hi, I'm Chris. Have I caught you in the middle of something? Is now a bad time to talk? I'm giving your sense of autonomy right back to you. The other problem with do you have a few minutes is I got a buddy of mine that every time he asks for a few minutes, it's 45. Mm. A few minutes, by definition, is 3 to 5. Everybody that asks for a few minutes wants anywhere from 15 to 45. Mm. So now I'm panicking because I got no idea how long you want me on the phone. So my approach, if I'm calling you, hi, I'm Chris, is now a bad time to talk. Have I caught you in the middle of something? You're going to be like, no, Chris. I've immediately personalized myself with my first name. I personalize me. You're more comfortable. I'm not trying to extract your name or use it against you. Next thing out of my mouth is going to be, I need 7 minutes of your time. If I need five, because the other thing I'm going to do is I'm going to get you to agree to more time than I need. We're going to be done early, and I will have given you time back in your day, which nobody else has done for you that entire day.
That's gold. I'm taking notes here, Chris. This is genius.
Here's another one. I get the biggest kick out of that. When we're teaching this, we say, be the airlines. You know, I don't know if these guys are doing this to you in Australia. I imagine they're doing it globally. What did the airlines do to stop getting criticized for late arrivals?
What do they do?
Here's what they did. Yeah. This is one of the great Houdini tricks of all time. They just moved the arrival time back so it makes it look like they're arriving early. They're arriving at the same time as before. It took me it's happened to me about 5 times before I realized what they were doing. Tremendous criticism there, you know, in the airline industry for late arrivals. You know, they got to brag about on time or early arrivals. Now your plane lands and they stop on a tarmac and they go, well, you know, we got you here early. And since we're here early, there's another plane still at the gate. We can't get you to the gate.
Yeah.
And I've said this out loud on the plane. I've go, you know, you'd have figured they'd have seen us coming.
Yeah.
You know, this airplane's pretty good size.
So true.
It ain't like it's actually a surprise that we showed up. So you're mad at the airport because they won't let you at the gate.
Yeah.
What really happened is the airport took the airline's word for when they were going to show up. You know, they said 3 o'clock, knowing all along they planned there being 15 to 20 minutes early to make the passengers happy. But the airline's looking at their watch and they're saying, you told us you weren't going to be here for another 15 minutes. We left this plane at the gate based on what you said. You guys can wait out on the tarmac. You lied to us. So I'm sitting there and I realize after the fourth time that gets pulled on me, I'm mad at the airport for not letting us at the gate, when in fact the airline lied about when they were going to show up. So you get a, you got a cold call you got to make. You know how long it's going to take you to run through that script. You don't need to leave the other person wondering when you're going to get done. You need to get done early, because then when you let them off the phone, you just given them the gift back of time back into their day. They don't remember exactly what happened, but they know they really like, they, you left them with a great feeling, and they dig that. And that's, you know, be the airlines. Lie to people about how much time you need. Only lie in the proper direction.
Yeah, that's gold. That is good.
You're going to try that this afternoon, aren't you?
Yeah, when I start cold calling again.
Well, actually, talking about the topic of Black Swan, so I know that's the name of your company. For those people who aren't aware, what is actually a Black Swan when it comes to negotiation?
Yeah, well, it's a little piece of information that you uncover that changes everything. And, you know, we like that as a title for the company. You know, obviously made it the website, blackswanltd.com, to help people remember it. But I can explain this to people, and you'll understand intellectually, and people have trouble grasping it emotionally. So, we'll say, when was the last time you were at the table when you weren't holding information back? When there wasn't something that would make you feel vulnerable, like your deadlines or your pressures or your budgets or what you really need. People, if they think about it, they're always holding something back, and it's always important. Otherwise, they wouldn't hold it back, which means if they could just share it and the other side wouldn't kill them with it, they could make a better deal. So if you're holding stuff back that's important, so are they. Which means if they could trust you, if you could get them to open up, you could make a better deal, better than what you had in mind. Now, the hard part for people to really wrap their minds around is what's in the overlap of the unknowns. Those, where those two unknown areas overlap, there's some real magic there. Nobody has, no matter how smart you are, nobody knows what's there unless you get into the negotiation. You know, there are black swans that they know is important, and there are black swans they have no idea because they don't know what you're holding back. And that's really where you turn negotiation from a zero-sum game to a positive-sum game. And it's built on trust and emotional intelligence tools that get people to talk despite themselves.
Many of our clients, or so many of our listeners, have service-based businesses. So they offer a service for, say, $10,000. The prospect says, I want to give you $5,000. And so it's between two individuals. How would the business owner negotiate with the prospect so they basically win, but also the prospect wins in the end? What are some techniques they could use?
All right, so, you know, there's a couple of things. The first problem that experienced business people, you know, it's like, it's a splinter in their mind, you know, was a line from The Matrix. You know, there's a splinter in your mind. You know, in my company, we love movie lines. You know, we'll blurt out a movie line from Caddyshack or Seinfeld or something crazy that's out of the blue. People think we're nuts. But first of all, 20% of your opportunities are fake opportunities. And we built out the whole profile on how to diagnose that in the first 20 minutes. And there's actually data out there independent of us that backs it up, because, you know, we call this proof of life. In hostage negotiation, proof of life is, do they actually have the hostage, and are they going to give the hostage to you? Those are two things that are not automatic. They might not have the hostage, and they might have no intention of giving them to you. They may actually be planning on killing them. In the business world, are they looking at you for due diligence, to just to convince themselves that their status quo is perfect and they don't need to change? Very common move of recently promoted executives. A newly promoted executive has to do due diligence, but if they have any brains, they understand if they start upsetting the apple cart and changing out vendors and suppliers and everything else in the first year, it's going to make everybody else at their level look like that they missed something, and there's going to be a lot of criticism for that. I've seen it happen a lot. People get invited in to make bids, you know, give us an RFP, request for proposal, come in, give us a presentation, and they don't hire anybody. And it's always a recently promoted executive that's doing that. So there may be no deal there. They got due diligence going on, period. The other possibility is they're simply looking to you for free consulting. Most companies will come in and show how they're going to solve all the problems.
Yeah.
Deliver some value. You know, the old drug dealer's approach. Let me give them a taste of what I could do. And they're going to want more. Well, they were looking for free consulting. Companies are doing this all the time. They invite a whole bunch of companies in to give them pitches. They scoop up all the ideas from each company that they like, and they implement it themselves.
Yeah. Coming.
Now, third outcome is you're the competing bid. And we call this the favorite of the fool. You know, there's an American phrase, if you don't know who the fool in the game is, it's you. And the business world, you know, they often refer to these people as rabbits. And when the book first came out, we had no idea how much this was going on. We didn't think proof of life was going to be an issue at all. And then we sort of sensed that it was a possibility. And I started bringing it up in keynotes that I was given. And a head of sales in one company says, oh, yeah, that's in the book, the Challenger sale. They actually ran the data. And they got executives to admit that 20% of the time when they solicited bids, solicited RFPs, talked to a vendor about possibly buying a product, fully 20% of the time it was a complete lie. They had no intention of ever using that vendor, ever using that product, that company. Now, people don't exaggerate how much they lie. Because that's the question. How often do you blatantly lie to people about whether or not you're going to do business with them? So if they're admitting to 20%, by human nature, that number's got to be higher. We teach people how to figure it out. And the people that are actively applying our rules are getting numbers up to 80% of the time. Mm. And when you start looking at the data on the buying process, and the data's out there in B2B, business to business, or B2C, business to consumer, it's all human nature decision making. So it runs the same. The data says that 50% of the time, if somebody's going to buy something, they've already made up their mind when they first talk to the salesperson. Mm. And no salesperson out there really has a close rate of 50%. What does that mean? Does that mean the salesman is blowing deals? No. It means the deal was never there. Mm. So, you know, mastering our stuff, and that's kind of where we get you when you get the basic tools down. If you could get 80% of your time back, let's say it's only 20%. Let's say, what would happen to your hourly rate if the 20% of your time that was purely wasted was no longer wasted? You stopped wasting your time on those deals. That 20% then goes into business that you're going to make. It's pretty much an automatic 20% raise just by getting rid of the deals that you were never going to make. It's kind of crazy when you think about it. It's fun when you're good at it, but it is crazy.
I'm just thinking about all the time I've wasted on deals that whenever you put on the table. It's actually scary.
Yeah, we had a prospect come in 2 days ago and just basically wanted all this free information. And we did a huge pitch, huge presentation, and they just took it and went, thank you very much.
Oh, no.
Yeah, there's no interest in buying, and now it all kind of makes sense. Yeah. But, yeah, it's common.
You know, a lot of people think that's just, you know, that's a cost of doing business. No, it's not.
Mm.
It's just not. Mm. I mean, we don't do it, and it's a scary thing to cut what you think to be opportunities out.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a real clear profile and a real simple diagnostic. And the people that we're teaching to do it, you know, if they can't, they get to the next meeting, they get to their ass, they get to their whatever their pitch is faster with the people that want to do business. Because the people that actually want to do business with you will make the decision much more quickly. The people that don't want to do business love to have you spend a lot of time with them because they're vacuuming up information from you and they never intend to pay you. So those are the longer meetings.
Yeah. Interesting.
It is. Chris, do people bring you in to negotiate deals or do they see you and go, oh, shit, Chris Voss is coming in.
I'll just give up. Just take everything.
Just take it. Take all my money. Are you still involved in negotiations?
Now, the cool thing of what our business has evolved into is we're literally coaching more than I ever expected that we would. I mean, I got a whole team of coaches. And I originally thought we'll train people. We'll train primarily companies. We'll get into training individuals across the board, but then we'll teach people to negotiate and we'll release them into the wild. And, you know, they will continue the learning experience themselves. They'll come to appreciate the value. First of all, negotiation is a perishable skill. It's like Jim Camp wrote the book, Start With No, one of our mentors. He called negotiation a human performance event. He was a football coach at one point in time. What does that mean? Whatever sport you're into, if you don't practice some, your skills diminish. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, you know, you can't hit the golf ball. You can't make the shot, whatever it is. You can't do it as well. You got to keep up. And we thought people would just automatically appreciate that, and they don't. So we coach all the time, a lot. And like a real coach, we send you into the game. Now, you may come back to the sideline. You may come back to the bench. We may watch you while it's going down. But you're in the game on your own. And like my son, Brandon, he's a president of the company, runs a company. When he was 26, he coached a merger where his coaching improved the deal by $35 million.
Wow.
Derek Gaunt, probably our best coach. He coached an insurance settlement when the insurance company only had to wait 2 weeks, and it was 2 weeks in December, so just before Christmas, and they wouldn't have had to shell out one single dime. And they got a $20,000 settlement 2 weeks before Christmas in that. I mean, so, you know, there's stuff we're doing across the board, and nobody resents us. You know, if we coach you, the other side's not going to resent you. As a matter of fact, they're probably going to want to do another deal with you because of this, I don't know why, but this tactical empathy stuff strengthens relationships. And people want to come back because dealing with you was a pleasure.
Hmm. Sounds like you need to do this course. Yeah.
Do you have coaches in Australia?
We don't have anybody in Australia right now.
Kills me.
But we got stuff online. We got tons of stuff online. We got every kind of course. We got the real simple stuff. You know, the intro basic to the skills. We got stuff being specifically designed for women by women.
Oh, that's good.
You know, whatever level you're at, we got something online. You know, we'll help you get better, no matter where you are in the world.
Actually,
we'll help you get
better. You know, Lisa's written down a question. Who makes a better negotiator, men or women? She actually wrote that question down.
All right, so at the top end, it's simply a matter of, are you coachable and will you get into it and enjoy it? And that is not gender related at all.
Yeah.
Now, we have seen consistently that women get a quicker start with this type of negotiation because it's, you know, they've been trained to be more intuitive since they were little girls. Like little, you know, women are constantly trying to teach little girls to be more intuitive, use their soft power from the beginning, because women know that, you know, males still dominate the majority of positions in the world. And to this day, and as we're leveling it up, but men are trained to be brutes and women are trained to be smart from the earliest days because of just sheer physical strength. So women have a head start on emotional intelligence over men. They just do. Now, once you start catching on, the top end, it's completely not related to gender, but women do get a faster start on this because they probably got a head start on it anyway.
That's interesting. I've got a question that's quite off topic. A friend of mine is going through a divorce at the moment, and the divorce is quite messy. Oh. And it's both parties are quite heated. In your mind, how would you bring it back down to a neutral level so people can be reasonable rather than making decisions based on emotion?
Yeah, you know, that's the hard thing about divorces to start with is the perceived injury on one or both sides is usually really, really deep.
Yeah.
And the advocates for both sides profit by deepening those wounds.
The lawyers in the ear. Yeah.
You know, the lawyers, you know, he's hiding money.
Yeah.
You know, he's hiding money. Yeah. He's lying to you. You know he is. And so, you know, they get to run the hourly rate up. It's to their advantage to inflame the other side. You know, in many cases, the smartest move from the person who's just trying to get through it is simply not fight back. You know, don't add fuel to the fire. It'll burn out quicker the less you fight back. Now, your advocate is going to get paid, you know, by the page, by the word. You know, they're going to want to run those billable hours.
Yeah.
By and large, I've lost my most of my positive feelings for the legal profession because of stuff like this.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to pull out. You know, your zealous advocate is just trying to run the bill, and that makes divorces that much harder.
Mm. Yeah, that's actually really interesting. I think lawyers have a lot to answer for. actually, on the subject of negotiation when things are potentially really heated, I know that you mentioned in your book that tone of voice is really important. And you've obviously heard Nick's voice. I would love for you to assess his late night FM DJ voice, because you were saying that there's three different types of voices when you're negotiating, and I love the FM DJ voice. There's also the positive, playful voice and the direct or assertive voice. But do you mind assessing how Nick's FM DJ voice is? Because I feel
I'll assess you both, because both you guys have good voices.
Oh, thanks.
Both of you guys downward inflect well. And, you know, occasionally women will push back and they'll go like, you know, I don't have a deep voice. Well, it's not about having a deep voice. It's really about the downward inflection at the end. You know, it's soothing. It's calming. It you know, there's a fair amount of argument, of debate among neuroscientists as to specifically how it happens. And, you know, I enjoy the debate, but I don't care how it happens. I just know it does. You know, like a guy I'm a big fan of these days, and I'm trying to listen to his podcast constantly, Andrew Huberman, neuroscientist out of Stanford. Great data. Some of the most cutting edge stuff. Plus, any question that he answers, he looks for the studies. Like, he's a PhD, and a lot of PhDs would be like, because I said, you know, I'm a PhD, and I said, I'm a doctor, I said. You know, like, I'm Jesus. You know, Huberman could be Jesus, but he's still looking for a study that he can bank on anything he talks about. So, you know, what has this got to do with what I, you know, just brought up, tone of voice? Because we've always said you got mirror neurons in your head, and my tone of voice is going to trigger your mirror neurons. It's going to cause a chemical change, and your brain is actually going to slow down. And I'm listening to Huberman the other day, and he says, well, I got news for all of you out there. There's no such thing as mirror neurons. All of you that have been talking about mirror neurons, they're just not there. Then he says, there is, however, some sort of emotional resonance circuitry which has the same effect. We just don't know how it works. And I'm like, all right, come on. You're picking on me because I talked about mirror neurons, but the voice still works. You just can't explain why. So the voice works. It triggers a chemical change. The downward inflecting voice feels good. Women need to be more careful about this than men, because a man might interpret it mistakenly as a seductive voice.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which
I always do.
Just trying to make a deal.
You know, and I'm a man. Like, if somebody tells me my voice is sexy, I'm like, that's cool. Yeah, I think I want you to think I'm sexy. And a woman is not looking to encourage that behavior in the workplace. She's not going to say, awesome, I wanted to be sexy. You know, and a man is flattered by that. A woman is like, no, that ain't working for me right now. So that's why we don't worry about it so much. But the smiling voice, if the real trick is, and you guys both do this a little bit too, if you can combine the two, that's a powerful voice. That moves you along because people feel the confidence, but then also I'm triggering other mirror neurons with a positive smile. People are 31% smarter in a positive frame of mind. So says Sean Acker, Harvard psychologist, in his phenomenal TED Talk, which I think is the Happiness Advantage. Which also, if you're looking for TED Talks to watch, one of the most entertaining ones out there. Hmm. Naturally, since the guy's talking about being funny, it's a very funny talk. It's just hysterical from beginning to end. But, you know, that's a tactical tool. You know, part of the Black Swan Method is understanding how to weave your voice to create as much collaboration as possible, as quickly as possible.
Are there any techniques you use to change your tonality depending on the situation, or do you just go, this is an aggressive situation, I need to change my tone according to the current stress of the situation?
But you know, it's kind of rule of thumb. I mean, you ought to have a positive tone to your voice a good solid 80-90% of the time. Mm-hmm. Now the downward inflecting voice should come before making a point that you're immovable on. Because you want the other side to feel it in their bones without feeling backed into a corner. You know, when we used to negotiate contracts, we don't negotiate contracts anymore. We just change them.
I experienced that literally the other day.
Yeah, you know, somebody gives us a contract with something in it we don't like. We don't ask them to take it out. We just take it out and give it back. Because the back and forth on a clause is really a waste of time. But when we used to do it, like we would never allow a work for hire clause. And I'd want the other side to take it out. And so we'd get on the phone and I'd use my late night FM DJ voice and I'd say, we don't do work for hire.
Oh, I'm sold. Sign me up.
Well, you know, I mean, you get it. That it isn't happening, but you don't feel attacked. Mm. Like if I say, you guys got to take it out. First of all, you'd feel a little attacked. Secondly, if you do it, you're going to feel that you need a return favor. Mm. What I'm also doing is I'm avoiding the back and forth quid pro quo by saying it like that. Mm. I'm not asking for it. I'm not demanding it. I'm not cornering you. You'll decide, and this is exactly what would happen when we did this. The other person would be silent for a second and go like, oh, well, I'll have it taken out. Now it's your idea. I didn't ask for it. You thought you came up with the idea, which increases the chances that it's going to happen. Now, if I ask for it, what's your response going to be? You're going to say, well, I'll go back to our team and I'll try. Well, I'll try means it ain't happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're in a relationship with a significant other and you ask him or her for a change and she or he says, I'll try, you don't get a good feeling out of that.
That's not happening.
But Chris, sweetheart, could you be home on time? Because we're going out to dinner with our best friends, but I'll try.
That means
you
never
do happen. Better than try.
So, Chris, would you say, would you mind removing that clause? Or do you say, how would you frame the statement? Because they say, could you do me a favor? Would you remove that clause or would you frame it differently?
No, he's saying
never ask.
Yeah,
never
we
ask.
Don't. So say, because I actually went through this recently and we were, because we do 6-month terms and people always try and do 3. And then we just started saying, we don't do less than 6 months. And they were like, okay. And it's weird because I just thought everyone would push back. But as soon as we said that, they're like, okay, fine, no worries. And they signed the contract.
How's your sales this month?
Actually, not bad. How are yours? Not bad. But yeah, I thought that was actually quite interesting.
Yeah, and it's a nice way to say no to something. Mm, mm. I mean, one of the keys to negotiation, really, a friend of mine that I met in L.A. Ned Colletti used to manage the Los Angeles Dodgers. They did really well when he was their manager. Phenomenal negotiator. And he and I are sitting around talking about it one night. And he says, yeah, you know, I always like to let out no a little at a time. And I thought that, you know, that's a perfect description, you know, because when, you know, when me and my team are teaching you, we don't want you to make your counterparts feel like they were caught off guard by no. Nobody wants to get smacked in the face with a no unexpectedly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's bad for the relationship. So what are the different ways we can start signaling the word so that the other side hears it without feeling backed into a corner? And you know, what you just said was, you know, we don't do less than 6 months contracts. You know, it's not a mean thing. It's not demanding. It's not cornering. It's just a real gentle way to say no without actually having to blatantly come out and say it.
Mm. Love that. Good tip.
Yeah, that's great. That's very good. I think I'm going to roll that out to the sales teams today.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, actually, I have to thank you, Chris, because in your book you talk about how to get a response to an email. And
yeah.
You'll have to tell Nick this tip, but it worked. And I told my team, because I said, look, I just read this great book and got this great tip from Chris. I want you to try it. And because I was talking to, like, we've got mostly females. And to be honest with you, we were all scared to do this because it felt really aggressive. So tell Nick what the tip is, because I thought it was gold.
And you know what I mean? And men think this is aggressive too. I think to some degree, women, for a variety of reasons, might be a little more sensitive because, you know, women, I hate gender-based stuff is real slippery slope to get into. But women have an instinctive feeling that being aggressive, overly aggressive, is probably a bad idea. Mm. I mean, that's kind of what their, you know, the cultural upbringing from the beginning is. If you're going to be aggressive, at least disguise it. You know, don't be blatantly aggressive. Yeah. You know, wars, fights, everybody loses. So there's probably a little bit more of an instinctive reaction to a fear of aggression versus assertion, which is a good thing. You know, if we coach you, we're going to teach you how to be very assertive and be really super sweet and super nice about it. You know, we don't want you to be aggressive. We do. Assertion is necessary for great negotiation. And people will instinctively think the no-oriented question is aggressive. And yeah, I'm sure that you're referring to, you know, the one line, have you given up on X?
That's exactly what it is. And it's so hard to write that, surprisingly, in an email, because it seems really, I don't know, like rude, but it worked.
It seems rude. It seems blunt. I mean, there's so much. This is the amygdala that I was talking about. You know, your survival mechanism being overly pessimistic and overly cautious of inflaming things. Mm. And the first time trying to get somebody to pull the trigger on that, like, oh my God, you know. And then I was at a conference once and a young lady came up to me and she said, you know, I tried that have you given up on text message and it didn't work. Now, this message literally works. Literally, I'm not kidding, 999 times out of 1,000. And you're going to get a response within 3 to 5 minutes of the person seeing it. The other thing, too, is the response is nearly instantaneous. But that does mean that the one time in 1,000, it doesn't work. And, you know, there are people that are scared of it now, like, well, I'm not using it if it's possible that it might not work. Look, I got news for you. My success rate on the Black Swan method is higher than yours. You know, we'll compare success rates anytime. But anyway, this girl says, you know, I tried it. It didn't work. And I go, okay. But since, you know, I'm going to coach you to send it out word for word. Word for word, tell me exactly what you sent. And she said, yeah, well, it did seem a little harsh. So I changed it. And instead of saying, have you given up on the project? My message said, should we give up on having lunch together to discuss the project? And I'm like, I wouldn't answer that either.
So how good's that?
So you got to trigger it word for word.
Jesus, it's really scary. So you just have to write. And you don't even have to write. You don't write, hello, how are you, all of that stuff.
All the nonsense. Just straight into the it.
This guy's like, I think you'd love that.
I love that. It's best.
Because you don't even write hi. If I get a hi from you, I'm like, what's wrong with you? You must be sick.
Chris, before we wrap up, what's one tip that you would give anyone that's going through a negotiation right now?
Well, it's kind of a tip and a half, which is, you know, they say negotiation is the art of letting the other side have your way. How do you do that? You let them go first. Mm. Now, you let them go first and you actually listen. You know, letting them go first is not just an opportunity to wait for your chance to make your pitch or to shoot down their argument or to counter pitch. Or to explain why they're wrong or explain what they missed. If you're explaining, you're losing. You got to actually listen to what they said. You got to hear for the parts that work for you that might have been what you asked for in the first place. And then you look at them and say, man, here's what you just said that I loved. Mm-hmm. Now they feel like it was their idea, which means they're going to implement.
Yes. Genius.
Now you've also given them some of their stuff, which now they feel heard, they feel listened to, they feel appreciated, they feel valued. Yeah. They're more likely to be flexible on the other stuff because they already got some wins under their belt. So you gotta let the other side is dying to talk, just dying, same way as you. You get an emotional upper hand if what you want is a better deal than what you had in mind and a long-term relationship where people are happy to do business with you. Let the other side go first and actually listen to what they say.
Good one.
So simple, huh?
Yeah. So try it.
I'm pretty much stuffed.
You are. Well, thank you so much, Chris. That was honestly amazing. I feel like I could just talk to you all day. I'm actually going to re-listen to your book. And I actually love listening because I feel like you're actually talking to me. But yeah, we feel really lucky that you've given us
with that central voice of his.
You're the central voice. Better than yours. but thank you so much, Chris. Honestly, it was such a pleasure talking to you today. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, let me know let your, you know, your people, your audience, your tribe, how to follow up. Like the website again is blackswanltd.com. BlackSwanltd.com. Go to the website. First of all, we got a lot of free information. You're going to get a lot a long way. Sign up for the weekly newsletter. It's free. It's concise. But wherever you are, we've got something that'll help you get better. You know, we got a short and sweet skills course, very reasonably priced. We got expensive stuff, but you're going to need to get the basics under you and get some wins under your belt before the more expensive, more complex stuff, before you get your return on your investment. You want to be coached by a woman. We got a couple of women that are hostage negotiators, phenomenal coaches. We've got a whole wide variety wherever you are in your skill level. We actually want you to get better. And if you don't come to us, we can't help you. And we hate not helping people. You're going to win. You're not going to make other people be losers. You're going to make people want to continue to deal with you. That's how we can help. And you stop leaving money on the table.
Chris just negotiated with our audience. Just said, you've just negotiated with our entire audience.
And probably won. But we'll put all of the links in the show notes, Chris, so people will be able to follow you on social as well and then also contact you. But thank you again for your time.
Yeah, that was amazing. Thank you. That
absolute goal. We're going to go and implement some of those things straight away.
Good. It was fun talking with you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks for taking the time to listen to today's episode. If you like what you hear, which we hope you do, we would love it if you could subscribe and leave us a rating and review.
And are you hungry to learn more? Talk to the world's best at listnik.com.
My God, listen to how husky you sound.
Just put on.
If you're not sick of us yet, and I'm sure you're sick of Nick, but if you're not sick of me, you can find the link to our social channels in the show notes, and we'll be back next time.